forecast. Lighter winds as well on coasts. Still pretty damp and cloudy day, though, I think, for most of us on Wednesday. And then come Thursday, there will be a change on the way, a brief one though. Cold easterly winds will be coming in from Scandinavia and Russia, so I think temperatures will be around 3 or 4 degrees by day, maybe even a little bit colder, so it'll feel quite raw and cloudy, and even the odd flurry of snow, but that's just about it. By Friday, it'll turn wet and mild again, so the cold snap will be just a flash in the pan, sort of. David.
Yeah, thanks. Balmy, hey? A ray of hope. Thomas Schaffernacker with the weather. Thanks, Thomas. And now on BBC Radio 4, our book of the week. And Germaine Greer reveals all about her rainforest years in her latest book, White Beach.
This is the story of an extraordinary stroke of luck. You could call it life-changing. What happened at Cave Creek in December 2001 is that life grabbed me by the scruff of the neck. I went there as a lamb to the slaughter, without the faintest inkling that my life was about to be taken over by a forest. Some of my friends tell me now that they saw it coming. Had I not quit London in 1984 and removed to rural Essex? Was not the first thing I did there to plant a wood? Was I not prouder of my English wood, which is all the wrong trees and in quite the wrong place, than anything else I'd ever done? They may not have been surprised when I bought land at Cave Creek, but I was. I was 62 when the forest became my responsibility, with no idea of how long I might be able to go on earning a living by my pen and my tongue. Our culture is not sympathetic to old women, and I was definitely an old woman, with a creaky knee and shockingly arthritic feet. What did I think I was doing, buying 60 hectares of steep, rocky country, most of it impenetrable scrub? For 10 years I would call it my forest, because I had bought the freehold, but that was only for convenience. I never thought of the forest as mine. I would walk down the creek, gazing up at the bangalow palms and rose apples that soared into the sky, and say to myself over and over again, who could own this? The Asia kingfisher perched on a trembling frond to scan the creek for fish had more right to it than I. It was only a matter of time before the forest would be given back to itself and a fund accumulated for its management. So I gave the place a name that referred to the project rather than the property, Cave Creek Rainforest Rehabilitation Scheme, CCRRS for short. How did I know on that bright December day in 2001 that the forest at Cave Creek could be rehabilitated? I thought I knew the answer to that question until I tried to answer it. On my first visit, I couldn't even guess at the rainforest on the upper slopes. What I could see was acres of exotic pasture grass with cattle dribbling into it, and as many acres of soft weed. Maybe it was the entrance to the national park, with its macadamias carrying strings of unripe nuts, black beans dangling their giant pea pods, and water vines hanging in huge swags over the road, that told me louder than words what I should have found in the perched valley beneath. I didn't know then how much of that exuberant vegetation was exotic weed species. That day, I saw a pasture bounded not by forest, but by impenetrable curtains of tangled lantana canes. I had no idea how to remove them, but I knew they could be removed. The other thing I knew was that it was my responsibility to remove them. Why? Because I could. I had money. Enough to get started, at least. Once I got started, I wouldn't have money for anything else, but that didn't scare me. I didn't need anything nearly as much as I needed to heal some part of the fabulous country where I was born. Everywhere I had ever travelled across its vast expanse, I had seen devastation, denuded hills, eroded slopes, weeds from all over the world, feral animals, open-cut mines as big as cities, salt rivers, salt earth, abandoned townships, whole beaches made of beer cans. Give me just a chance to clean something up, sort something out, make it right, I thought, and I will take it. I wasn't doing it out of altruism. I didn't think I was saving the world. I was in search of heart's ease, and this was my chance to find it. We have inherited a planet that is richer and more various than could ever have been imagined. Every day brings discoveries of new riches, coral reefs in the darkest depths of Arctic seas, thousands of species in thousands of genera, some older than history and some brand new. Biodiversity is the name we give to the extravagant elaboration of this, our planet. Every one of the millions of life forms on Earth is an Earthling like us. The tiny snail negotiating the edge of that lettuce leaf is my cousin. It and I share most of our genes. Its survival and the survival of its kind depend on me. To give up fighting against nature, to make it bring forth profit, is to enter a new kind of existence, which has nothing to do with serenity or relaxation. It's rather a state of heightened awareness and deep excitement. As I limp back down the mountain with my pockets full of fruit, on my way to prepare the seed for planting, I know that as many will grow as should grow. If the forest has its way, paucity would be replaced by plenty. Once the vanished trees return, an invasion will follow. Mosses, lichen, ferns, orchids, mites, weevils, beetles, moths, butterflies, phasmids, frogs, snakes, lizards, gliders, possums, wallabies, echidnas, all will reappear in their own sweet time. The forest is the bottom line. Without it, the thousands of species that have evolved with it will fade from the earth. Technology has no solutions to the problem of biodepletion. The only way of keeping the extraordinary richness and exuberance of this small planet is to rebuild habitat. I had no idea in December 2001 that what was about to fall into my hands was a hotspot of biodiversity. I knew that my patch was surrounded on two sides by a national park, which was a plus, and I knew the national park was at the northern extremity of a World Heritage Site. That area, consisting of a broken string of small rainforest remnants, is now called Gondwana Rainforests of Australia. The forest fragments are of major conservation importance because of their high rate of endemism. What that means is that surviving in them are many species that can survive nowhere else. If I've written this book properly, it will convey the deep joy that rebuilding wild nature can bring. Not that the forest is peaceful, anything but. The sweetest tree frog is a ruthless predator on hundreds of species, including other frogs. The spiny rainforest katydid that has just landed on my keyboard, dressed in his mad suit of particoloured fronds, is a voracious killer too. I sit quiet to watch him as he takes off. He's barely airborne before a rufous fantail flits out of the cheese tree and snares him for her fledglings. Both bird and prey are wonderfully special. The katydid is dressed with such crazy excess that he looks more like a green man crossed with a leafy sea dragon than a flycatcher's meal on wings. The rufous fantail turns hunting into an aerial circus, whirling her wings and tail so that she tumbles and spins, only feet from my face. If I know anything at all about botany, it's because my younger sister taught me. For years we went together on botanizing holidays. She taught me how to key plants out, something I'm still not very good at, partly because I tend to rely on my photographic memory and leap to an identification without going through the steps from family to genus to species. No, she'd say, go back to the beginning. Is it rutaceous or myrtaceous? It's a kunzea, I'd say, so it must be myrtaceous. Wrong way round, she'd say. What are the distinguishing characteristics of the myrtaceae again? Jane taught me to use a loop to look for oil dots and to search for tiny variations in flower form. This is the really nerdy part of botanizing, but pernickety drudgery is an essential part of any scientific discipline. At the end of a day's rambling, after we'd picked the ticks off each other, Jane and I would sit with a pile of specimens spread out on a tabletop, and she would take me through them, one by one. Jane is a practical botanist, doing what she can to preserve what's left of the biodiversity of the Mornington Peninsula where she lives. Her own garden, with its murmuring veils of casuarina trees standing ankle-deep in their fallen needles, its tossing sedges fringed by coastal banksias, not to mention its lawn of wallaby grass that grows like green fluff and its drifts of greenwood orchids, is deservedly famous. It was Jane who taught me about the perils of Australia's steadily rising water table, which is bringing to the surface the salts deposited over millennia by the buffeting ocean winds, and carrying the spores of the cinnamon fungus that's destroying the vascular system of woody plants all over the island continent. Together, we've gazed in despair at the glittering expanses that are the ulcers caused by salt. Jane's one person who isn't afraid to sit beside me as I turn off the metalled roads and plunge down farm tracks, looking to see what's really going on in the Great Southland, counting the dead and dying trees, photographing the new sand dunes that are travelling across the wheat belts as the wind rakes the treeless land. It's because of my sister that I've been looking for a piece of land in Australia, something we could work together to manage, to protect, or restore. We started looking in New South Wales, but every property we looked at presented an insurmountable problem. A stretch of coastal salt marsh was covered with exotic species like African lovegrass that have virtually annihilated their less vigorous native cousins, and however diligently I weeded, they would continually reseed from neighbouring properties. A stretch of riverbank was strewn with crack willows that would readily root downstream every time the river came in spate, choking the watercourse and increasing erosion. What I really wanted was desert. For years I've gorged on the life that pounds within what we were taught to call the dead heart of Australia. From the sudden glitter of dawn, with my ears tuned to the electric sizzle of the finch's song against the limitless silence, to the creeping violet fingers of evening. In 1990 or so, I'd gone to Al Halkri to see the silk batiks produced by the Anamajera women. They'd gone bush, and while I was cooling my heels waiting, I realised that I was surrounded by a breast-deep sea of silky blonde grass that swung in the slightest breeze. Nowhere else in the Northern Territory had I seen unmunched, untrodden vegetation, or clean waterholes where people could drink rather than acres of trodden mud. Then I knew why they killed and ate all the cattle. In the paintings by the women of Utopia, you will see again and again the streamer patterns of the sacred grasses that are the glory of the place. From the Anamajera, I learned what I'd do with any piece of Central Australia I might get my hands on. I'd leave it to recover from nearly two centuries of misguided exploitation. Eventually, after 2 years of looking, I had to admit that I was knocking at the wrong door. Then, in 2001, I went to give a lecture at a women's centre just south of Brisbane. Afterwards, when I was chatting to the organisers, somebody said, "What about Ken's mother's place?"
Jermaine Greer has been reading from White Beach. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions for BBC Radio 4. And you might like to know that Woman's Hour is doing a special programme on Thursday about women and land. Jermaine Greer will be talking about her newfound role as an eco-warrior, and how she's spent the last 15 years restoring that patch of rainforest in southeast Queensland. Woman's Hour is on Thursday at 10. Just moments away, it's the shipping forecast, and to take us safely there, we go sailing by. And now, with the time at 12 minutes to 1, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, or on Tuesday the 28th of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Atsira, South Atsira, Forties, Cromarty, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Shannon, Rockall, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle and Faroes. The general synopsis at 1800, low Malin, 969, expected Wales, 977 by 1800 today. New low moving rapidly southeast, expected Biscay, 983 by the same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Atsira, South Atsira, 40s. Southeasterly 7 to severe gale, 9. Occasional rain, moderate or poor. Cromarty, southeast 6.